Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy Nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Hello and welcome to the Rest is Entertainment Questions Edition with me, Marina Howe.
And me, Richard Osman. Welcome to the Question and Answers Edition. Hey, Marina, how are you?
I'm very well. Yet again, the questions have been terrific. There's some really funny ones and some really intriguing ones.
I think we have my favourite question of all time coming up later.
And it was both of us when we saw it, so yes.
Shall we start with this? It is a question from Sally Ward. Thank you, Sally. She has three children. She says, over the years, I've been really impressed with the amount of storyline, humour and drama that children's TV writers are able to include in a 5 or 10 minute slot, e.g. Ben and Holly's Little Kingdom, Danger Mouse, etc. I feel these writers have a tough job to pack so much into that small slot. Her question is, do you think children's TV writers get the respect they deserve from the industry?
That is a terrific question. I also love children's TV, and having watched a lot of it when I was young, obviously, but also when I've had three children who are still quite small, things like Hey Dougie, Bluey, I mean, Abney and Teal, which I absolutely loved.
What's it called?
Abney and Teal. Oh my God, it's absolutely terrific. There's one guy, a guy called Andrew Davenport, who did Teletubbies, In the Night Garden, Moon and Me, which is the most recent one.
The guy who lives in the big golden palace.
Yeah, well, yeah. Russell T Davies said, I actually think that Andrew Davenport should be considered in the same breath as Tom Stoppard and Samuel Beckett. First of all, you're so right about the concision required for that type of writing. And I always think if you're made to write something short, you become a really good writer. This is the advice whenever people ask me about journalism. I always just say, write really small things. Write something in 500 words.
Write really small. Write really, tiny writing.
Then see if you can write it in 250 words. Then see if you can write in 100 words. And you will not waste a word. They do not waste a word in Hey Dougie, in Bluey. There's so much plot in 5 minutes. I mean, there's a lot of plot in 5 minutes of Peppa Pig. It's extraordinary how they do it. And if everyone knew that, then you wouldn't be sitting there sometimes when you're watching something on one of the streamers thinking, Jesus Christ, nothing has happened for 25 minutes.
We've got 9 episodes of this.
This is so indulgent. It's so indulgent. Now, children's television has...
Come on, Laura Dern, shoot someone.
Yeah. Someone, Abney and Teal, which is, and also the people who work on these things, like Adrian Scarborough, an actor I pay a fortune to watch in the theatre and have done on many occasions. He does the voiceover at Abney and Teal. A lot of really amazing writers, Russell T Davies being one among them, started in children's television. Yeah. It is the best training ground in lots of ways.
And lots of brilliant comedy writers start out on those shows as well. Yeah. Pingu is brilliantly funny. It's such a great way to get into the industry. And again, the short form versions of it do sort of mean it's perfect for our culture. And some of the biggest YouTube channels are kids' things as well. I started years and years ago. I used to write with David Williams when he was David Williams. And the first thing we ever did was a thing called I Hate This House, which is on CBBC.
I remember that, yeah.
And, you know, we got into it via there. And so many writers get their first break just writing little short things for children's TV. You know, really properly funny people. But that's great. Bluey is like one of the
Bluey
great phenomenons of the world, right?
But it's interesting that Sally identifies the concision, because I think that is such a good way of becoming a good writer at anything, is to be able to write short before you do whatever people now think of as long form. And a lot of long form journalism is just long. The internet has given people an infinite space, and they have lost the art of concision. And I really think that certainly on television, they've learnt to write short.
To anyone writing books as well, if you're editing a scene, lose the first 4 paragraphs.
Yeah.
You know,
come in as late as possible.
Always come in as late as possible and come out as early as possible. Yeah. And, you know, people will just keep on reading to the next chapter and the next chapter. But yeah, Kids TV, Sally, you're absolutely right. It's genuinely underappreciated treasure and has been for many, many years. But if you get it right, incredibly lucrative.
I've got one, okay, from Sean Freeman, Richard. I wondered about multi-camera shows such as Gladiators, which aren't transmitted live. Would a director select camera shots as live during the events, or would they cut footage together later?
The answer is both. So if you're making Gladiators, you know the shots that you want. You probably, I don't know how many cameras they'd have on that, but even on a panel show, you've got 6 or 7 cameras.
They've got a lot of cameras because they have so many reactions.
And they've got lots of fixed rig cameras and all sorts of things. So a director knows roughly what's going to happen. They've done rehearsals, so he knows what a game is like. He knows they're going to go from Bradley at the beginning, and then they're going to go up onto the podium, and then there's going to be a fight, and then one of them's going to fall down, and then there's going to be another interview. So he's got a rough idea of the geography of what's happening. He sits next to someone called a vision mixer, and the vision mixer has the output of all of the cameras, essentially. So at any one time, if you go into a gallery, if you see, like, on sometimes on TV when you see the inside of a gallery, and there's kind of 40 different screens, and they've got the feeds from every single camera there. And that's when the director's working out that camera 4, which has got to get the big high shot, it actually needs to go to the left because you're missing something there. So the director is constantly working out where those cameras are pointed. The vision mixer is doing a live cut of the show as it goes along. So roughly what you would be watching on TV is what the vision mixer does. But then all of that footage goes into the edit. So you've got that master, which is the vision mixer, is put together with, you know, the director calling out various shots. So, you know, if Duel is taking place and you need to cut 3 seconds out of it, that's an edit. And the edit, of course, you've got to go to a different camera shot. So when you're in the edit, you've got all the footage from all those different cameras. You've got your sort of master, which has been cut in the studio, and you drop in fun reaction shots from the audience, or, you know, if there's a brilliant reaction shot from one of the gladiators. So you're always looking for interesting shots which weren't put into the cut in the studio. So it's an incredibly time-consuming process. That, funnily enough, we talked about AI last week. I was talking to a very big entertainment producer, and I said, in entertainment, where's the first place we're going to see AI really make an impact? He said, the edit. He said, AI will be able to sort of drop in all of those shots that you want almost instantaneously. So that first cut of a show is going to be done incredibly quickly.
God, so, I remember people saying right back in the, you know, when X Factor or whatever was in its absolute pomp, and it, you were almost watching something created by the sort of karaoke Lenny Riefenstahl. And he had each quarter of that show had its own edit. You know, the milking of emotion, this is why I bring in Lenny Riefenstahl, trying to make it tug on every nation's heartstrings, everyone to react in exactly the way he was managing them into reacting. It was so much work that each 15 minutes of the show had its entire own edit team.
Yeah, and that, by the way, I don't like. I think that way of doing stuff got found out. You would see reactions on that show which you knew were not the reactions to what happened.
Absolutely.
And a decent show, you'll be watching through the master, then on your other screens, you've got all the other cameras showing exactly what happened at that time. So you can put in the reaction of what happened at that time. Occasionally, you have to go searching in a different bit of the show to have a reaction that's the same because you didn't quite catch it. But they would consciously choose shots from different parts of the show and put it in. Like sometimes they do things like on X Factor or Britain's Got Talent where there's silence. You think someone's come on, they're so bad, everyone's silent. You think, but of course they weren't. It was absolute nonsense. And, you know, they would edit things in a way that I thought was cheating the viewer. But yeah, by and large, the vision mixer and the director shoot as live, cut it as well as they can live, and then an editor has an incredibly tough job of patching that all together, you know, putting the music on, putting the dub, you know, all of that. But it's a real treat to see a great editor at work, and it's an unbelievable treat to see a director and vision mixer at work together. The speed they work at, and the director talking to all the different camera operators also, who are brilliant, and getting different shots and then being cut up live in a gallery, it's a real art. Here's a question for you, Marina. It's from Henry. No.
Hello,
surname.
Henry.
He probably does have a surname.
He's declined to include it in this case.
You know what? He's like Madonna. Wherever he lives, like in Ruislip, he's so big. People just go, yeah, Henry.
Okay, now tell me what he's asking.
Henry says, oh, nothing.
Nothing.
No. Just Henry says, you often refer to a third act in movies, although it may apply to other formats. What is the third act and why is it so important?
A three-act structure is a sort of really traditional, but it's a satisfying way of telling a story. So in the most traditional sense, you would have the setup, act one, a sort of confrontation, struggle, act two, and third act is the resolution. So when we talk about why the third act, if we don't like the third act, it's a bit of a problem because it's the tying up of the film.
First act, we meet people, we see where we are, we see what the situation is.
People have done interesting things with this, like famously the sort of Hollywood producers Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer in the 80s with their sort of high concept movies really refined and pushed this structure so it was, you can almost physically feel it happening. You've got like in a very hot first act, then a second act with a crisis, and a third act with kind of redemption via triumph, and probably in the case of their movies like Days of Thunder, Flashdance, a freeze frame ending. And it was you can almost feel it. Funnily enough, my late father, some people it's so ingrained in them. My late father-in-law was a filmmaker, and he used to say to my husband when he was really small, when they were watching a movie together, and he'd go, oh, end of act one. And so in my husband's sort of understanding of story kind of grammar, really, it's almost instinctive. And as I say, it's a satisfying way of telling a story. And by the way, this can apply to an episode of lifestyle programming. Yeah.
Grand Designs.
Grand Designs is, classic, I was about to say, is the real three-act structure.
Yeah, which is, here's a wreck. Oh no, they're pregnant and the windows haven't arrived. Let's take a look at this lovely house. First act, second act.
But sometimes, Richard, sometimes it ends in tragedy because that happens.
Yeah, listen, tragedy does happen. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And yeah, anything, even factual programming can be divided like this, but it is a satisfying way to tell a story. And so when things have problems in the third act, it is obviously particularly problematic because that is the resolution of the story. And a lot of things kind of can lose their way, I think, in the third act.
But I always think also, because books also by and large have three acts, I certainly always write. You never consciously do, but I think there's the setup, here's the business, here's the conclusion. But I'm quite good with act one and act three. But act two is what sometimes you think, okay, I know where we are, I know the situation, I know the characters, I know where we're going to end up, and there's this big sort of set PC type thing. And they think, there's 50,000 words in between those two things. And that's where the fun of writing comes, is sort of working your way through that second act. But yeah, but once you sort of know that structure, you see it absolutely everywhere.
But it's a good way of testing. I mean, testing yourself as a writer. The brilliant TV writer Brian Fuller, who did sort of Hannibal, who's done lots of Star Trek. He's an amazing TV writer, really kind of eccentric genius. And he said to me once that, if ever I've got a way that I think with Act Three would end, I always say, right, I'll take that and I'll put it at the end of Act One. And then now I've got to, it makes you, instead of thinking, that's how it's going to end, he'll make that the end of act one. And then you kind of, you're getting deeper into it already. And so it's a way people can kind of play around with it a lot to kind of test themselves and to challenge themselves.
Well, that's
it.
Once you know the rules, you can play about with them. But also it's worth saying that in these sort of big sort of multi-series things, that there's all sorts of different structures going on, and also with shows that have advertising breaks necessarily have to have a slightly different structure than shows without advertising breaks.
You need to have something exciting before the break.
Shakespeare used to have five act plots.
There are many different ways, but actually, if you stand right back from the story and think about it, you'll see that there's been a setup, then there's been a problem, and then there's been a resolution. And almost all stories work, even if they're happy, sad, whatever, will work in that sort of a way if they're satisfying.
That's the end of our act one. Shall we go for a little break? Just if you are listening to this, we still have our favourite question of all time to come.
Yes.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving. To your local store, like now. Go!
Welcome back to the Rest is Entertainment Questions Edition.
This question is and answer edition.
Only you can answer this, Richard. Steve Parrott says, on Pointless, do the winners get a trophy each?
Do you know what my favourite thing about this podcast is? We go from the entire future of humanity with AI to do people on Pointless get a trophy each? And also, I know which segment is more interesting to people, and it's this one. Yes, they do get a trophy each, and I mean, it would be crazy if they didn't. I guess sometimes people have been on Pointless Celebrities have got more than one trophy each. I think Sean Williamson has four. That's a guy with a lot of downstairs bathrooms.
Yeah.
So they do get a trophy each. How big is the Pointless trophy? It is surprisingly small. However, it is bulky. It's proper cut glass. I mean, you could
and
definitely...
And in terms of what it means, it's essentially unscalable. It's enormous.
It is the single most coveted trophy in the history of television. That's the interesting thing with TV shows. Obviously, in the very first script, it said the coveted Pointless trophy, and I don't think they've ever changed that script, so it is the coveted Pointless trophy. But yeah, it's got sharp edges, it's heavy. You could definitely, it's a proper murder weapon.
Just saying, if you ever needed one for your books, has anyone ever murdered someone with a quiz show? Awards, surely, are all murder weapons. I mean, look at an Emmy, that could take you out.
Funny enough, in my new book, We Solve Murders, out in the shops in September,
but you can pre-order now.
Available to pre-order, an award is used as a weapon. How about that?
That's a world exclusive. Very exciting. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Because if you've ever, anyone you're ever holding, you're thinking this is simply the sharpest and most dangerous and pointlessly heavy thing that there is.
Yeah. So that's spoken to someone who's held a lot of awards. I mean, I wouldn't know. I've certainly seen Jeremy Kyle
hold awards,
things that I could. only journalism awards. But yeah, so you get, you get one each, but you only get half the money.
That's showbiz.
Yeah, it really is showbiz. They light it from like it's a monolith, like it's the Statue of Liberty. And they put it on a plinth and turn it round. That's the shot they always show. So I think when people first see it, they think that's not as big as I think it would be. But then I think they rather like it.
Yeah.
Don't clip that bit out and put that on TikTok. Come on, guys. Play fair. Question here from Jason Swaby. No one but Swaby in the corner. He says, the gaming industry is expected to generate over $170 billion this year, five times greater than that of worldwide movie box office revenues. Brackets source USA Today. I like someone who includes their source in the question. Thank you, Jason. At what point do you think the video game industry will be taken seriously by non-gamers and recognised as culturally important and as significant as the film and music industries?
Yeah, you're right, Jason. It is interesting. It's ahead of movies and music, I think, but it's behind TV and streaming. I think people sort of recognise it as a fact of commercial and business life, like it's like the sort of, I don't know, the marketing industry or the precious metals industry or something, that it's a big industry on the sort of, but they don't think of it culturally. I think that it wasn't taken seriously for a long time, clearly. Criticism is always an interesting part of it, is that critics have been a big part of making, you know, the New Hollywood was a big part of making the New Hollywood was Pauline Kael, the kind of amazing film critic who brought all these filmmakers to people's attention. This is, I'm going back to the 1970s. And she kind of created a different way of talking about movies. And things were taken much more seriously than they had been necessarily before. The gaming industry has been relatively resistant to criticism in some ways, I think. And if you look at things like Gamergate and these kind of big, horrible kind of online pylon scandal things, there is something quite gatekeepery about that as an industry that shuts people out. Also, industries need stars to become mega in that cultural mega way. And you notice that all the people who do, I don't know, voiceovers for games, things like that, they're coming in from another industry. So obviously you'll get this, some of the kind of games houses and the people who make the games, people think of them as kind of enormous, but they're like a brand. They're like Disney. In terms of stars, tell me who its stars are. Industries need stars to become, that kind of cultural industry needs a star to become enormous.
Three words. Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, is they punch massively above their weight. Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto, these things are multi-billion franchises. Some of the biggest cultural icons of our time, Mario, Sonic, the Mario movie was beyond massive. You know, Legend of Zelda is enormous. Minecraft is massive. Yeah, but I think perhaps because video games came of age slightly after that era where we had this shared mass culture, they've always existed. They've always been slightly siloed off. You know, we grew up with television where everyone watched the same thing, and so television became a massive cultural conversation. And video games, which are beyond huge and affect everything we do, affect all the movies we make.
Completely, and a culturally and artistically incredible in many, many ways.
I mean, something like Grand Theft Auto, you just think, I mean, this is one of the greatest works of art I've ever seen in my entire life.
They always regarded their competition as movies and not other games. But they put themselves against that to say, these are who we compete with.
But I think to answer the question, I think that they don't have the same cultural cut through because of when they came of age. I suspect, I'm not sure any industry will ever have that cultural cut through again, but they seem to be doing all right without it. The first ever show I ever worked on was a show called Games World on Sky, which is 5 times a week, half hour. Oh my god, that's bad. But you know, in the early days, you know, that was, you know, when with Sega Mega Drive and all that kind of stuff, and television has never really done video games brilliantly,
no,
is the truth. But it's its own world, it's its own culture. You know, FIFA is one of the hugest brands in the world, and a generation have absolutely grown up with it. But it's not talked about in the same way as Succession.
No, it's not. But weirdly, within the industry, I mean, managers were saying that they'd seen players and obscure players on FIFA for the first time. I think that's absolutely incredible.
Well, we've had like pointless questions where we said name a kind of a Spanish Premier League team, and anyone who's played FIFA just goes through the whole list.
Yeah.
But I suspect if you're waiting for it to become a lingua franca, that probably isn't going to happen. Time, I think, for our favourite question.
Our favourite question ever, Colin Skivington. When a character in a TV show or film throws something into a river or the sea, are the production team obliged to retrieve it? Or do they get permission or just do it anyway? I remember an episode of Luther where Idris Elba threw something into the Thames and I thought, surely you can't do that. Colin, epic, thank you.
That is, yeah, I mean, genuinely, I hadn't thought about it before. I'm not sure I have an answer to this one. I wanted the question read out because I wanted Colin's brain to be represented on the show. But yeah, when someone throws something into the sea or river,
I have asked prospect experts about
have
this.
You?
Okay.
Great.
So first of all, they would like to say that the things that go into the water are normally duplicates. So if you see someone chuck their phone into the sea or something like that, it is often a rubber duplicate. It's not
unless you're Rebecca Vardy.
The agent, please.
Oh, sorry. Unless you're Rebecca Vardy's
you're just
agent.
On a classic WAG holiday destination, yeah. The North Sea. anyway. If a car goes in, it's had its engine, any oil, anything else like that removed, it has to have before it goes in. And obviously they have to retrieve that.
Ugh.
Having said that,
health and safety,
they don't. Things like some things degrade if it's photographs or paper, you know, people chucking a photograph into the sea. You can see kind of you know this kind of visual lexicon of shots.
Oh, like
that
someone
you see
on the back of a ferry just tearing up like a wedding photo.
Yeah.
And just throwing it over
into
the side.
Wake. Whoa. Yeah, we've seen that many times.
They don't
I'll level with you, Richard. That doesn't get retrieved.
It's not like 8 divers going down.
Off the record, but, you know, or anonymously, props people will say the only time they retrieve them is if they float because they've got to go for another take. And it's there standing. I was like, oh, there's already a load of pictures in this sea.
Of course.
So someone has got to go on a small boat with a pool skimmer and get it out so that the next phone or rubber phone or photographs or whatever can go in. And if
who's
it doesn't
throwing
sink,
something that floats?
Well, I mean, photos float. You've just described a situation where you rip up the photo and, you know, that will float. Someone's got to go in. And then they've got another photo of her that's going to get ripped up again. They might do it 10 times, you see. So you need the pool skimmer. You need the guy in the boat, or it might be a lady.
If I was the director, I'd say, you know what? Actually, throw it in the bin. Actually, just put it in the bin.
But there are a lot of props at the bottom of sea and of river that have simply not been retrieved because you're not going to get a diver to go down there to get, you know, the phone, the rubber phone that you've thrown in. These are many of the Thames's secrets.
It's like a lake full of golf balls on a provincial golf course.
Yeah, yes.
Colin, that's such a great question, and I love the fact that you had the answer to it as well. I will never see anyone...
I had to ask props people for this.
Yeah, but listen, that's given their props. I'm struggling to remember ever seeing anyone throw something into the sea. I'm not sure I've seen the episode
I have.
Of Luther.
No,
really?
Oh,
really?
Come on. Wedding rings, photos. Yes, definitely. Things off the end of a pier. How many times?
Bodies.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Sure. They have to recover those.
Yeah. They have to recover those.
Assuming those poor actors.
Yeah.
And there's an episode of Seinfeld where they knock golf balls into the sea.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm so going to keep an eye out for that. The next time there's like a big drama where someone throws something into the sea, everyone is going to remember this episode and remember the name Colin Skivington. Colin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. More in this vein, please. And if you do want to send questions in, there are so many incredible ones, which we'll be getting around to. The address is therestisentertainment@gmail.com. And we have a huge repository of questions, but please add to it.
There's a question that I really wanted to get to this week, but I think we've run out of time, but we'll do next week, which is, what is the biggest waste of time meeting you've ever had?
Yes, please.
That's
okay.
Good, right?
Tune in next week.
I'll give you a week to think about that one. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.